In the book of Romans, the Apostle Paul writes, one person's faith allows them to eat anything, but another, whose faith is weak, eats only vegetables. The one who eats everything must not treat with contempt the one who does not, and the one who does not eat everything must not judge the one who does, for God has accepted them all. So that leads us to ask, carnivore, herbivore, or omnivore?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Welcome to the 1356th edition of the Food Chain Radio Program. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Sasebo who are tuned in to the Food Chain podcast at metrofarm.com. Whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. And also in the studio with me today, we have intern producer Vanessa Salas, who is an agroecology student at UC Santa Cruz. Vanessa, when we put all of the material on the table today and said, what should we talk about? You pointed to the caption, carnivore, herbivore, or omnivore. And so I have to ask you, carnivore, herbivore, or omnivore?
Yeah, as of right now, omnivore. I've been through a lot of phases. I was vegan, vegetarian, all that. But yeah, I've landed on omnivore, and I think I'm going to stick with that.
Oh, good. Well, I can't think of anybody better to ask about carnivore, herbivore, or omnivore than Fred Provenza, who is the author of Nourishment, What Animals Can Teach Us About Rediscovering Our Nutritional Wisdom. Fred, welcome back. It's been a whole week. Missed you.
Yes, well, wonderful to be back with you and Vanessa. Absolutely the case.
We look at the Bible written over 2,000 years ago, and the Apostle Paul is trying to figure out how to hold people together. And they're fighting each other over the right way to eat. I would bet, Fred, that you could find the exact point in time where we lost our natural wisdom about food and started arguing about it.
Michael, I think the way that you opened this about judge not, huh? If a vegan diet works for your body, then stick with that. If vegetarian works, stick with that. If omnivore sticks, work with that. And I think historically, our hunter-gatherer ancestors did very much that. And depending upon the environment where they were born and raised over many generations, they adapted to co-evolved with the plants and animals that were in those environments.
And as you mentioned in the last show, mothers taught their young, mother animals taught their young how to eat in utero by eating their way across the landscape and selecting those plants that they needed for their nutrition, for their health, and for the healing.
Absolutely. And you know, reading in the anthropological literature, I was so impressed to hear about how they, prospective parents, young parents, they were very concerned about the diet, not only for the mother, but for the father as well prior to conception. So I think there was this deep linkage that was there historically, excuse me, you know, all of our ancestors. And I think I can't identify an exact point where all that started to change. There may be people who would be better at that, but I think it's really been a gradual process, mm-hmm. would be my assessment of that. And I'll just talk from my personal experience. When I was a young boy growing up in the town of Salida in central Colorado in the mountains there, and I think back to folks of my grandparents' generation who, you know, many had come over from Europe. They brought with them many of the traditions that they held, including eating, which is, right. As we know, fundamental to life. They all grew big gardens. They knew how to grow very, very delicious foods. Most of them had chickens. Some even had a hog. They hadn't lost, you know, when they like to make their own sausages and so forth. They hadn't and lost their connection.
Pickled vegetables and
yes, put up all it, yeah. All the fruits and vegetables. And I think back to that a lot now, and how they were still connected to where food comes from and to growing and eating really healthful foods. And they were all trim. You know, the diet-related diseases we have now weren't a part of what was happening then. I think then to my parents' generation, and I can really think back to how the processed food started to become such a big part of the scene, white bread, for instance, and fake juice and, you know, juice from concentrate and on and on and on. You can go down the list, yeah. But I think it really hit during my parents' generation. And, you know, I think they were naive to that. I don't think they really realized quite what was happening and how that was going to play out over the ensuing generations, to the point where we now have really a pandemic of obesity and diet-related diseases. And, you know, so when I look back, I see how that evolved over time, and how, at least for my wife and I, it took a very conscious effort to start to realize what had happened, and then to back away from all of that. And sort of as Jack LaLanne, the old fitness guru, used to say, if man made it, don't eat it.
Don't eat it. Let me take you back a little bit farther than that, way, way, way back in time to when we first figured out this whole business of managing plants and animals. And became farmers and ranchers instead of hunters and gatherers. And through that process, do you ever consider reading any of Jared Diamond's work, Guns, Germs, and Steel?
Oh, yes, read the book, absolutely. And he makes the point that agriculture was the greatest mistake that our species ever made. Greatest mistake our species ever made, and going down that path.
Why did he say that?
Well, he was seeing all that was happening relative to, for instance, plant agriculture, growing plants, which that's not getting against vegans or vegetarians, but plant, you know, all the plant agriculture, what that was doing to soil, to the destruction of soil, and this idea that you destroy the soils, you destroy the civilization. I think he was looking at, and in Collapse, his book Collapse, he was talking about the collapse of civilizations and some of the factors that contribute to that.
And I was just wondering if that wasn't where our taste for real food began collapsing, because in storing stuff away, we could start eating things out of season and out of place. And
yes, go ahead, Michael.
Well, I just think today, when we're hungry, all we have to do is swing into the convenience store, and there's something in a fancy, colorful plastic package that came from thousands of miles away, and by virtue of some really fancy food technology, has been made to taste really good.
Oh, it's incredible, huh? It's incredible to see that and to realize the grapes that you might want to purchase came from Chile, and it's incredible. The other thing I think that influenced that, and Mark Shaxter does a great job in the Dorito Effect of talking about really how our food preferences have been hijacked. And I think about the varieties of plants that we grow. Now we accent yield as opposed to phytochemical richness. You know, our ancestors, the hunter-gatherers, would have been seasonally selecting different foods. But, you know, I'm thinking of tubers like camas plants. I'm thinking of all the berries and the pemmican that they would make. Those plants were all phytochemically very, very rich. They've got a richness of flavor and a pungence to them that a lot of the varieties that we nowadays simply don't have. And as we talked last time, that phytochemical richness is very important for our health and for the health of the animals who eat those plants. And if we eat animals too, that's important for their health and for our health as well. So breaking those linkages has really led us down a path of foods that lack plant and animal foods that lack flavors, that don't have a richness of flavor, and that in turn don't have a nutrient and medicinal kind of benefits that come from eating native kinds of plants.
When you mention pungousness or that phytochemical buzz you referred to that you get from native plants and grasses, I thought of choke cherries.
And absolutely.
You know, choke cherries is probably something city folks probably rarely would have the opportunity to taste. And it is a puckerer of the mouth. And you say it's all about the phytochemicals. What exactly do you mean by phytochemicals?
Well, they come under broad classes, Michael. That's a very good question. Broad classes like phenolics, terpenes, alkaloids, and within each of those classes, then there can be tens of thousands of different compounds. So it gets quite nuanced and complex. You know, any one plant can have dozens, if not hundreds. If you look at the phytochemistry, for instance, of oregano or sage or thyme or any of those, it's a page, three columns, single spaced of compounds that are in that.
So that sounds dangerous. But what we can almost bank on is that in industrial foods, manufactured foods, the foods in those fancy plastic bags at the convenience store, not so much phytochemicals at all.
That's right. We've selected for growth, as you meant, growth as opposed to phytochemical richness. You have to realize from the plant standpoint, there's a cost to producing these phytochemicals. It takes nutrients, it takes energy. And so a plant that's producing those is actually producing a bit less biomass, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. It's a trade-off that's the plant's making.
They have that theory in wine too, you know.
Yes.
If the wine grape is smaller, the taste is going to be much better because you're going to get all of those phytonutrients. Holy smokes, we're going to take a quick break. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson with Fred Provenza, who is not from the University of Washington. Mm-hmm. He's from the University of Southern Utah. Professor Emeritus.
Utah State University.
Utah State.
Utah State.
Now, where is that?
Utah State is in Logan, in the northern part of the state.
Oh, okay.
And then the University of Utah is in Salt Lake City, and then BYU is in Provo. Then there is a Southern Utah State University that's associated with Utah State, but that's down in St. George. So,
which is a pretty little town, too.
It's a pretty little place, yeah. Actually.
Okay, we're gonna be right back, and we're gonna have a lot of fun talking with Fred Provenza because we could talk with him for hours, and I'm sure you would love to listen to it. So stay tuned.
And now, back to What's Eating What on The Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Yes, we are back, and we're talking about the argument that we all have about what we should eat and why we should eat it. And I guess my next question, after learning where we lost touch with what was right by virtue of our taste, and the taste our mothers taught us about the taste of the land, a taste of place, once we lost that, we started arguing about what is the right thing to eat. Issues of diet and health, and this is from Fred Provenza, issues of diet and health become religious convictions with iniquity, damnation, and salvation as common themes. How did that happen, Fred Provenza?
I think as we move from from a common way of hunting and gathering and moving across landscapes where all of our ancestors were doing that wherever they were, and moved more into, as we've been talking, this in agriculture over the last 10,000 years, really, that's been playing out. And then in the last 100 years or so, into this huge, huge industrial agricultural kinds of complexes, we moved away from our connections to the landscape. And then, most people now live in cities. And
we have no connection with our food.
No, and we have no connection with our food. And issues like we talked about last time, where is your food coming from? And feedlots nowadays, for instance, CAFOs and so forth have really been talked about in great detail about the ways that animals are treated in those under those conditions, which we talked about last time. And so for many people, that alone becomes an issue of, I don't want to participate in that. I don't want to eat meat because of that.
Mm-hmm. Just a second, Fred, I have a quick question for Vanessa, the UC student. Vanessa, if you were to put a sandwich board over your body and walk through the campus with a sign that read, "I love meat," what would happen?
Honestly, I don't know.
I'm
sure people would come up to me and say some things, but yeah, there's a lot of like vegans and vegetarians mm-hmm. on campus.
So it's a very current thing, and you were once there too. Yeah. So it is something that is very much a part of our culture, and we argue about it. But we've been arguing about it for thousands of years by virtue of what we read in the book of Romans from the Apostle Paul. Hey, quit fighting over your food, he was saying to his adherents, and yet we still fight over our food. It must be just fun, I guess. It must give us something to argue about.
Yes, well, and nowadays with issues related to mass extinctions, climate change, of course, is really a big one. And meat and production of meat has really been in the crosshairs related to climate change. Many people, some more than others, have really denounced beef production because it contributes to their arguing contributes greatly to global warming. And, I was just reading a debate between two really prominent people, one on the side that, livestock can save the world from climate change. The other on the other side, there's no evidence whatsoever that that's the case. And so these debates are ongoing. I think the thing that, and you started that way, Michael, and I agree. I think the thing the only way for us to move forward as a species seems like to me is to look for commonality, that we're all Homo sapiens, we're all humans, we share more than we don't share. And I think what happens is through the press, for instance, the press can turn thous into its. And, there are people with very strong opinions and beliefs that operate the press on all sides. And rather than recognizing our common humanity and thinking about how can we work together as brothers and sisters, all of us, they turn thous into its, and then away you go, whether right. It's the war on one another related to what we eat, to literal wars and so forth. That becomes a big deal. Let me say a couple of words here related to this whole business of climate and so forth.
Please do.
I think Last time, I think we made the point, or I did, that, you know, soil is of great interest, always has been, as we were talking, and it is nowadays, too. And, you know, agriculture can really degrade soils. There's no question. And it doesn't matter whether you're talking about growing plants in monocultures to feed people or to feed livestock, or livestock out grazing on landscapes. All that can be done in ways that degrade soils, but it can also be done in ways that build up soils. And of course, I was trying to promote that in the second paper that we're discussing, that there are ways that can really be done. I also made the point that plants turn dirt into soil, and diverse mixtures of plants turn soil into homes for herbivores, carnivores, and omnivores below and above ground. It's as complex and as simple as that. You know, that it's that diversity that's really becomes important. And people that are farming nowadays are starting to really recognize and promote that. It's not everybody that's doing that. What is it? Maybe 5-10% at the most, but it's a start. It's so important.
Right. And of us who eat the meat can increase those numbers significantly through the cultural selection of spending our money.
That's right.
The last time we spoke, you addressed this issue of cows grazing across the pasture. And I thought of the time I spent with Joel and Teresa Salatin in Virginia, and they have a beautiful pasture with lots of different things. It's a banquet of grasses and things for the animals to eat. And you mentioned that as the cows graze their way through that pasture, they're picking up all of these different kinds of phytochemicals.
That's right.
And incorporating them all into their meat.
That's right. And literally, there'll be, you know, tens of thousands of these compounds. When you think about the complexity of that, and then you think about the body and the body's ability to know what to do with all that, it's mind-bogglingly amazing. It's a miracle, really. And it's very hard to study that. You can study one compound at a time, and that's the approach that we're, or sure, a handful, you can do that. But still, if you've got 10,000, 20,000, 30,000 compounds that
interacting
with one another and with cells, it becomes really an amazing kind of thing. You know, and so that diversity that you're talking about, I'm thinking about a study that was done on the Tallgrass Prairie, if I recall correctly. But the point applies whether it's there or on Joel Salatin's place or wherever. And this is some of the debate that these two, I won't mention the two main players that were having this debate, but you know, this part about biodiversity becomes so critical, and grazing in ways that enable diversity. But this study showed that after 23 years, these study areas that had 16 perennial plant species had 150 to 370% more nitrogen, potassium, calcium, magnesium. You could go down the list in their plant tissues relative to monocultures. When they just grew these in monocultures, they didn't have that. They also had 30 to 90% more water and nutrient holding carbon in the soil. That's so hugely significant. And it just makes the point that biodiversity isn't just a buzzword that ecologists invented ages ago. It's real, and it matters in terms of creating the health of systems.
Let's take that thought to the value of food. I have this tongue-in-cheek laws of the food chain, and the third law of the food chain is cheap food isn't. And I think of the difference in the values of meat that are growing on those diverse pastures that have incorporated all of these thousands and thousands of phytochemicals as compared to those animals raised exclusively in feedlots or of one or two different kinds of grains. And, you know, to me, boy, cheap food isn't.
That's so true, Michael. And I think that's where we miss the point. You know, when we focus simply on yield or on yield with plants or on how can we grow a cow, steer or heifer really quickly in a feedlot, we're emphasizing yield. And yet what our bodies need is this total nutrient density and richness. And we actually, this is a key point, we actually end up eating less when the foods that we're eating are nutrient dense. We satiate more quickly. The body's needs are met. We're not eating just for whatever the cells and organ systems need the nutrients that are in the plants and the meat, and when they're nutrient dense, we end up eating less. And the animals do the same thing. When they're able to select from a broad array of plants, they end up eating less food, and yet their health is enhanced, and they produce just as well, if not better, than animals that aren't on those kind of nutrient dense diets.
So this makes so much sense, and of course, it makes too much sense. It gets right down to it. So we go back to what happens is why aren't we incorporating this notion into all of our production of animal agriculture? Well, it's not cheap to do. You know, it's just valuable food. Cheap food. And so I've been thinking about what you said about the power of the press. And going back to the Apostle Paul in the book of Romans, the Apostle Paul, you know, he's trying to bring people together and make them stick, to hold them together. Not so certain the press is in the same business.
No, absolutely. And you can see where the press ends up pitting people against one another. And it's really, it's a tragedy. It's a tragedy. When you get people who think they hate one another due to different ideologies that the press and other entities have reinforced, you know, you turn thous into its at that point. And really, but if you get people face to face interacting with one another, you know, I taught a class for many years at Utah State University, an upper level undergrad class that dealt with the kind of topics we're talking about, all the issues of the day nowadays, and trying to think from an ecological standpoint, how do we address all these issues ecologically, economically, socially, and so forth. And the students that would come into that class came from all different backgrounds across campus, from one range extreme to the other, far left to far right, and so forth. And the first day of class, when we'd go around and introduce one another, the tension and the anger in that room was so palpable, it was unbelievable. But over the years, I learned how it was perfect. Their passion was perfect. Because what we did was we engaged in dialogue. It was rigorous. The students would actually lead some, without going into too much detail, the discussion and stuff. But what happened, and I came to see my role not as a talking head, as a prof or anything, but as a facilitator of a conversation that deals with the issues of the days, the hugely challenging issues, and not in a way that polarizes everyone, but in a way that, okay, these are issues. How can we work together? And so my job was to set the occasion so that we could have the conversation. And I'm telling you, when that happened, and when everyone felt free to express themselves and knew that they weren't going to be attacked by the person sitting next to them or across the room, that they were all thous in there, the conversations that we had, the dialogue that we had, the free-flowing discussions that we laughed, we cried, it was like, this is what needs to happen. These are huge issues. We need to work together. We need to be working. And, you know, I think about Washington, D.C., and I think about a lot what goes on, different presses and different people running different presses. And I think it's a shame. It's a shame.
It's the money.
The people in D.C., that's right. And it's people in D.C., should be models. They should be models for how to work through these issues.
Well, Fred, I have to tell you that your classes sounded a lot like my Shakespeare classes, which were just so much fun for the very same reason.
People. Yes, and no one ever missed a class.
There you go.
They loved absolutely coming right. to class.
So, folks, we're going to take a quick break, our last break. This is the Food Chain Radio. Michael Olson with Fred Provenza, Professor Emeritus of Behavioral Ecology at the Department of Wildland Resources, Utah State University. When we come back, I'm going to ask Professor Fred the big question, impossible burgers. Do stay tuned.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, we are back. This is the Food Chain, Michael Olson. What's Eating What Radio? And a lot of what's eating what these days is the climate, which seems to be on the forefront of just about everybody's concerns. The earth is burning up. We're not going to make it another 10 years. And it's all the fault of animal flatulence. Isn't that right, Fred Provenza?
Yes, that's, you know, certainly cattle, sheep, and goats are in the crosshairs related to that. And let's pick up on that idea, Michael, related to both carbon dioxide and the ability of diverse plant communities to sequester and store carbon. And that's where grazing management does become really critical, and grazing in ways that promote diversity. We were making the point that when you have a diverse mixture of plants as opposed to monoculture, wonderful things happen with nutrition of the plants and the ability to store, to produce water and nutrient-holding carbon in soil. Well, you know, each plant species, we talk a lot about the gut microbiome. Now, if you think of the soil as a gut microbiome and think about diversity of plant species, each plant species harbors a unique community, a rhizosphere, they call it, rhizosphere community. Diverse mixes of species interact in ways that enhance the soil microbiome, nutrient availability, and plant chemistry because of each of their different chemistries, as we were saying. A key point, too, you know, we often think of, well, how can we fix carbon in soil? And we think, well, litter, you know, the dead plant material that dies and then gets incorporated to the soil is important, and it is. But here's a finding that I think is so profound that the soil scientists are doing. And they show that nutrient inputs from living roots are 2 to 13 times more efficient than litter inputs at forming both slow cycling mineral associated soil organic carbon. That's a mouthful, but that's that fixes carbon in the soil long term, and the fast cycling particulate organic carbon. So nutrients from roots stimulate growth of microbial populations. That's just like in the gut microbiome. You know, you eat a diverse array of foods, you're stimulating all this huge array of microbiome. Dead microbes can make up over 50% of all soil organic carbon, adhering to mineral surfaces and forming soil aggregates. So how we graze and what we do becomes very important
It sounds as though you're saying, in essence, life begets life.
That's absolutely it. And diversity, whether it's humans of all different cultures and creeds and backgrounds, or plants, when you work together, when you come together as community, incredible things happen. And that's our oldest teachers, right? The plants are telling this, that they're trying to tell us, look, you know, come together, work together. That's a topic we'll get into in our last conversation, I know. But let me make one other point here. Okay. And then we can move on. But methane is such a huge issue. You know, you mentioned that at the beginning, flatulence. It's actually when ruminants, cattle, sheep, goats, all the deer, elk, most of the African, on and on, they're all ruminants. And so they've got this compost heap in their stomach, basically. And when they eat these plants, there are certain bacteria there that produce methane. And so livestock get accused of being the key deal with regard to methane. But let's just step back a second. Regarding methane, you know, they estimate that there are 737 million tons emitted globally each year. 50% of that comes from natural sources such as wildfires, wetlands, termites, oceans, and volcanoes. Half of it. 17% comes from fossil fuel production and use. 15% comes from livestock, 9% from landfills and waste, 4% from growing rice, and 4% from biofuel burning. So agriculture is the largest source of anthropogenic methane emissions.
Meaning very us.
Meaning us, that's right. Closely followed by the fossil fuel industry's intentional release, that's gas venting, and unintentional leakage, fugitive emissions, as they call it, of methane. However, and this is the key point that I want to make, methane from livestock and fossil fuels are distinctly different. Methane from livestock begins as carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and it's recycled by plants through photosynthesis. In contrast, methane from fossil fuels is newly added to the atmosphere from deep within the earth, where it's been for millions of years. The largest global cattle inventory, this is the final point, was 1.1 billion animals in 1989. Cattle numbers have declined from 1989 to 2019. They've been going down. At the same time, methane emissions have been going up, 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 up. Thus, most increases in methane emissions are coming from burning coal, oil, and natural gas for electricity and heat and transportation. It's not cattle that are contributing now to this increase.
But cattle are easy targets. They're out there in the pasture, chewing their cud, looking at you. Pretty mm-hmm. easy.
Burping all that methane. Yeah. And so, you know, but it doesn't get put into a perspective. Let's put one more perspective on it, and then we'll... So use of fossil fuel accounts for 75% of all greenhouse gas emissions. Compared with pre-industrial levels, fossil fuel emissions increased atmospheric carbon dioxide by 50% and doubled methane. Overall, fossil fuel emissions rose by 60% from 1991 to 2019, while agricultural emissions rose by only 16%. As we were saying, you know, cattle numbers have actually declined globally. And while a figure of 14.5%, that's typically the figure that's used for greenhouse gas emissions from agriculture, that number varies like crazy in different parts of the world. In the UK, for instance, cattle and sheep account for only about 4% of emissions, while cattle account for 35% of emissions in Latin America and the Caribbean. In the US, where global consumption of meat is the highest in the world, agriculture contributes 9% of emissions. 4% of that is from animal agriculture. 5% is from plant agriculture, from growing plants. So think about that. If we shifted, say we did what some people argue, let's get rid of all livestock and simply eat plants. A shift to a plant-based diet would mean growing far more crops, which could badly affect soil health and increase agricultural greenhouse gas emissions. Given projected increases in soil erosion and greenhouse gas emissions from industrial farming, where crops are grown in monocultures, crops such as soybean, corn, so forth and so on. So I think what's important is to step back and think about what are the relative contributions, and then move away from this idea that everybody either needs to be a vegan or everybody needs to be a carnivore, and recognize that each person's body is unique, what works for them is going to vary, and that what we need to be thinking about is how to produce food in ways that enhance the diversity of life on this planet, starting with our oldest teachers, the plants.
It's interesting you say you have to accept other people's bodily needs. And the Apostle Paul concludes his thoughts on the issue, for God has accepted them. They're not you, they're them.
And, absolutely, I love that. That's a deep recognition, huh? And if we see that we are all, if we use the term God or the absolute or the unmanifest, mm-hmm. that we are all manifestations of that, then who are we to judge? You know, I mean, we're all manifestations of that. So why not think about, as Rutger Bregman argues in Humankind, A Hopeful History, about getting to know the person you think you hate and starting to think about how can we all work together? We've got tremendous, tremendous challenges ecologically, economically, socially. And I'm very much looking forward to visiting with you in our last discussion about some of, you know,
the solutions,
and just this idea of how important it is to work together.
Yeah, we have a few minutes left, but we're not working together right now. As a matter of fact, we're being driven into different corrals, as it were, by those who have the ability to do so. One of the means by which they're doing that is by saying that those animal agriculture is the suicide of the species and stuff like that. I mean, I actually saw that headline here just recently, and I thought, boy, this is really going deep fast. But it seems like they have a solution for us, and that's to stop eating real food and eat their food, such as the Impossible Burger. Now, I look at these, I call them pretend foods, and I also call them oligarch foods, because essentially they are manufactured under various patents. And so if they can get us to eat their pretend foods, manufactured under various patents, they can totally own what we eat, especially if they convince us that eating good plants and good animals is somehow deleterious to our environment or our species or whatnot. And so they put in front of us on the plate the Impossible Burger. Your thoughts?
Oh, absolutely, Michael. And so that's where moneyed interests have all the interest in the world in promoting the kind of press that you were reading, right? And then starting to pit the common person people against one another, right? And arguing that, you know, this is the way to save the planet, that the Impossible Burger is, or any of the plant-based burgers are better for human health. They're better for environmental health. But, you know, I reviewed a paper a while back. It's been published by a highly prestigious group that they were looking at inflammatory markers, some 90 inflammatory markers, and they were comparing plant-based meats with real meats, and they found that there was really no difference in inflammation. And they thought, wow, these plant burgers would be far, far better in terms of inflammatory response. After we eat a meal, there's an inflammatory response in our body, and plants, it's typically lower, but interestingly, there was a study in Australia that showed they compared kangaroos that were eating diverse diets with livestock that were eating, were fed in a feedlot. And they found that there was hardly any inflammatory response when people ate meat from kangaroos. Now, that those kind of studies are being repeated with livestock on diverse diets versus, because you could say, well, it was the kangaroo, not the, you know, and so forth. But it's, I would venture, and the studies that are being done in New Zealand and here in the United States are consistent with this, that it's that diverse diet that's getting in and creating the phytochemical richness in the meat that's having that influence on low inflammatory response. So, you know, you have that. Then you have the environmental part, and you've still got all this plant agriculture and monoculture that's involved in that. If you're using cultured meat, I've read analyses of the amount of energy it requires to produce that meat. It's tremendous, you know. So there we are, back in the fossil fuel loop, back in the methane emission loop, back in all of that stuff. And so the more people look in depth at some of the fake products, the more concern there is about, well, really, are they really any better at all for human health? I often think, do we need one more processed food? You know, do we need one more processed food? Why not get back to wholesome foods and to growing those foods? And, you know, and at a personal level, grow a garden.
We're going to have to call it a day right here, but with the full knowledge that we will be back shortly to talk about bringing food back to us. Thank you all for tuning in. Remember, Michael Olson, second law of the food chain: the farther you go from the source of your food, the less control you have over what's in your food. Thank you, Fred.
Yeah, you bet, Michael. Wonderful to be with you again.
And we'll see you soon. Thank you, Vanessa.
Yeah, thank you.
And thank you all for tuning in. See you next week for more What's Eating What Radio.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.